Thanks everybody for coming. I've seen a few new faces, which is good. So with my style, it's more like relaxed, informal. So if you have any question along the way, feel free to interrupt me and put up your hand and ask me questions. I don't mind that. I prefer the interaction anyway. I prefer the Q&A. I find it we can learn from each other by having the Q&A. So I will try to leave some time at the end of the night to have that session of the Q&A. So if you have any doubts or questions, you can feel free and have a chat with me. So tonight, the topic is overcoming the challenges. I think before we jump into challenges, we need to understand what challenges are. I came up to think that there are a few forms of challenges in life. It could be related to relationship, which is mainly our interactions with people, mainly in our relationship with others and ourselves. It could be also in a form of situations. For example, for you, probably assignments, exams, work, or even environment. It could be drought, for example, that's situation. It could be also related to the body, where you feel sickness, you feel lethargic, you feel some disability in a form of the body. Or it could be also in a form of financial. So some people are struggling with a financial situation. So that could be one of things that are considered challenges in our life. However, challenges are part of life. They are expected. I doubt anyone can live without any challenge in their life. If you have met that person, brilliant. I doubt there is even one exists without a challenge in their life. So that's part of life. However, having challenges not necessarily mean or cause you to have suffering. So challenges and suffering, they're not the same, and they're not causative. So people who are having a lot of challenges in their life, not necessarily they have a lot of suffering. Sometimes you can have no challenge in your life, yet you are in a lot of suffering. So in Buddhism, it's not so much about overcoming the challenges, but rather overcoming the suffering. So suffering happens when life happens not the same way what we want it to be, not the same way how we expect it to be. That's when we feel the suffering. Suffering is more mental, what happens in the mind. And the beauty of it is because challenges are part of life and sufferings are, in a way, optional, there's a way out. So tonight, I'll just focus on how we can overcome the suffering that we can experience in our life. Have you heard of the simile that the Buddha gave about second arrow, first arrow, the simile of the arrow? Put out your hand if you haven't heard of that simile. So in one of the discourses, the Buddha gave a simile of somebody hit the person with an arrow. And a fool is somebody who's going to stab themselves with the second arrow, meaning that what they do when they are stabbed with the first arrow, they were complaining, thinking about where this arrow come from, what is this? What is the material of the arrow, and who did this to me, instead of pulling the arrow out or looking for a solution as to heal the first arrow. So what this person is doing is actually stabbing themselves with more arrows. So these are the suffering that the Buddha say, that what the reaction that we have when life gives us a challenge, for example. When your body is sick, you start thinking, why am I sick? Why me? That is already a second arrow. And that are optional. We are bound to sick. Nobody is born 100% healthy forever. We are bound to sick. That's just a condition of life. But we can make ourselves more sick by thinking unskillfully. So that is a second error. So basically in Buddhism, when we overcome the suffering, we try to overcome this second error. Most of these are quite habitual. Sometimes we are not even aware that we're doing this. That's why it's called practice. When it comes to Buddhism is all about practice. And the more you practice, the more you get better at it, and the more things happens quickly. Like at the beginning of the practice, it might take you, let's say, 1 month to overcome it. With practice, it might take just a day. So that's just keep in your mind that all of these are practice. Don't expect that once you understand it intellectually, you can apply it right away and it will happen like that. It's not like that. So it all takes time. And that's also good. It's actually a good thing. So how do we do that? I came up with a few steps. So, the first step is to be aware, to be mindful. Because if you're not aware that you are having the suffering, how would you act upon it? How would you even think about a solution? How would you even think how I'm going to help myself overcome this suffering? So the first step, you need to be aware. You need to practice mindfulness. The meditation that we did just then was just a tool for us to be more mindful in our daily life. Because the more you practice, the more it becomes your habit, the easier it is for you to be aware. And what to be aware of? There are a few things that you can be aware of. The easiest one is the body. A lot of times, your mental suffering manifests in the body. I can give a few examples. For example, you can have bad sleep, you couldn't sleep, or you lose appetite. Another one is indigestion, or even if you experience a broken heart, for example, if somebody hurt you, you have a physical manifestation. Even though you mentally feel sad and down, but there's a physical manifestation in the body. For example, like there's a physical aching in the body because the mental is in pain. So be aware of those. And nobody can tell you but yourself what's going on in your body. So that's why it's important for us to be aware of our body, to understand our body. So when things happen, we know something is going wrong. And because we know something is not right, therefore we try our best to overcome it. So use that as a tool to alert you that there's something that you can work with. It might not be necessarily, the physical manifestation might not be necessarily, of course, might not be necessarily related to your mental well-being. It could be just physical illness, but it could also because of your mental well-being. That's why the awareness side of things is very important. The awareness will help you, guide you in a way to tell you whether it's because of your body is having an illness or it is related to your mental well-being. So that's the first step. And the second step is quite simple, it's just acceptance. Simple, yet it's the hardest thing to do. Well, again, it comes down to the extent of your suffering. The more the weight of the suffering, the harder it is to accept. Small suffering probably is easy for you, but if it's really, really deep and hurting you so much, it might be very hard to accept the reality. So what is it to accept? I can think of two things to accept. The first is that to acknowledge, to accept that you are having the suffering. And the second is the event that made you feel that way. For example, if, let's say, hypothetical example, a mother having a sick child. So the suffering is, she will feel something in the heart. So she will feel sad, she will feel worried, she can't sleep, she can't eat. That are the suffering. But then the event is that the child is sick. The child is in pain. That's the event. So there are two things that we need to accept. We need to accept our own condition, and the second is the reality of things. And acceptance can be quite powerful, because when we fully accept things, sometimes the suffering just disappears. It's no longer there. But sometimes it's lessened. But with full acceptance, usually the suffering disappears. But this acceptance is a work of the heart. It's not something that you can tell yourself intellectually that this happens and I need to accept it. It doesn't work that way. It's the work of the heart. The heart needs to be fully open and receptive and completely opening to the event of life. So it's a full, complete acceptance to things. And with that, it doesn't happen with force. However, it takes time. That's why practicing of acceptance, also practicing of patience. And with patience comes kindness. Because there is no patience without... Patience without kindness is not patience. So when we practice this patience, we also practice kindness, because we cannot make things happen. Things happen according to its own time and condition. So even though you wish, I can accept this, you can't do it that way. It will happen by its course. What we need to do is just opening the heart, be kind, be gentle, forgive. And that's why I say the practice of patience requires a lot of kindness. Sometimes with life, when things doesn't go along with what we wanted, we usually react with a lot of anger. And this anger, if you really notice mindfully, it actually hurts nobody but yourself. That's with practice, when you realize that that's what you're doing to yourself, you'll automatically let go of the anger. But then, of course, it's not that simple, it's not that easy in reality. That's why you need to practice slowly with acceptance, with forgiveness. You forgive that somebody has hurt you, and you forgive that things have happened the way it happened. But acceptance is not, doesn't mean that you condone the behavior. There are some behavior is completely harmful or harmful to others, so we're not condoning that sort of behavior. But there is no help by being angry at that, because if you realize the anger itself causes a lot of pain and suffering, not just in the mental, our mental conditions, but also in the body. Because people with anger, a lot of anger, usually have high blood pressure, they probably couldn't sleep very well, could also have heart disease. So it also manifests in the body. So that's why anger is something that we need to practice to let go, because it doesn't help at all. It actually hurts ourselves the most. So just realize that acceptance, we are not condoning bad behavior. It's about accepting and forgiving the behavior. Right? And with that, automatically, we will have this. That's step three. We automatically will let go. And when we let go, we're making peace with things. And that's when we feel somehow liberated. That's when you notice the difference in your mental well-being, that you're free. You're no longer bounded by all these past events that causes you a lot of pain.
So you let go the pain and also the anger that associated to it, or even the greed that you have towards events. And this is the last, no, this is not the last one, the second one.
And after we let go, it's important to take some time to reflect. Because we can keep repeating the same mistakes again and again and again and again. The reason is because we haven't understood things correctly. By this step of reflection, it's important to understand what to understand. We understand ourselves first and foremost. We understand what triggers that happen within ourselves. What sort of reaction we had in that particular situation. How did we think? What did we say? What did we do? And when we did that, what was the repercussion? When we said things like that, what was the repercussion? So that is just to assess the whole situation so that we can learn from it and make a mental note that we try our best not to repeat the same mistake. Because mistakes happen. Mistakes, the same mistakes happen because of habits a lot of time. Like there's a trigger and you're not aware of the trigger and you just keep habitually doing the same thing again and again. And after that things you said or you did, then you realize, I did it again. That's why it's important to reflect and understand ourselves, and therefore we can find a way how we can improve in the future not to repeat the same mistakes again. That's one, to understand ourselves and also understand the situations. Understand the context of the situation and understand the other person. Why the other person did what they did? Where did they come from? So it's not just what happens within ourselves, but we try our best to understand as much as we can the whole picture of the events. With that, then it will grow in our wisdom and our understanding when we relate to other people. I suggested to do the reflection after the letting go process is because it's important to be calm and not to have all the negativity when we do this reflection. So that when we do the reflection, it's not flavored or colored by our negativity. So it's good to be calm and clear so that we can have better judgment of the situation. However, not necessarily we can do all the letting go part or the acceptance. It might be too hard. It's okay. It's okay. We can talk to people if that helps. We can talk to somebody who is not caught in the situation so they can be more impartial in this situation and help us understand the situation. That can also help. And with reflection also can help us to find the solution. In Buddhism, we are not just being passive, but at the same time, what we do is we develop wisdom. We develop understanding. With wisdom, we need to know what needs to be done next, because it's not good enough just to sit down and accept things the way they are. There sometimes is important also to take action onto something. So that's why the last step is to find a solution. Is there a solution to this situation? Is there something I can do to improve things? If there's nothing, there's nothing. If there's something, then why not? It might not be the right solution, but at least we try. So it's important to skillfully find a solution to this, like skillfully act on the situation. And then this goes in a loop. After the reflection, it goes back to step one, because we need to practice awareness, keep to practice to be understanding of what's happening in our mind and in our body. That is how I see it. This is just to uproot
the second error. Not to uproot, to heal the second error. This is to heal. Because these steps happen because we're already suffering.
However, Buddhism, the depth of Buddhist practice can go beyond that. It's actually the core of the practice. It's not even to heal the second error, but rather not to have the second error to begin with.
So how the Buddha prescribed
the Noble Eightfold Path. Basically, it can be categorized into three groups: the immorality, the practice of concentration or mindfulness or meditation, and the practice of wisdom. So if you really want to be free, completely free, not to have any suffering at all, that's the way to go. But we are not there yet. That's why we need to be practical where we are at and work with what we've got. And that's why we're chipping away bit by bit of our suffering. The more wisdom we have, the less suffering we have. Simple as that. We are having suffering because we don't see things as they are. We don't have the clarity of the mind. But when we do, we have less suffering. Because the Buddha said, life in essence are impermanent. Dukkha, suffering, and non-self. If we can see that, then easy. We have no problem. We have no suffering. We'll be peaceful all the time, 24/7. But we're not there yet, which is fine. We're okay. And I'm not there yet too. So that's why we still need to practice. And the more we practice, the more we see the benefit, and the more we are more encouraged to practice. So I guess that's the gist of what I want to say. If you have any questions.
Within the community, is there a particular name for this flow that people go through?
Not really, I just came up with those.
Okay, it's an old tradition.
Is it?
Yeah, I was part of a group that worked through that as a way for people to understand, to wake up. And that first one of awareness is like awareness of that circle of it happen again, whatever it is, and not knowing why, like getting angry all the time, but not understanding where it's from, and then working into where did that come from. And you mentioned the place, you look at, like, I get angry and then you go back, when did this start? Okay, so I was like 7 years old, and, all right, I was at home and then mum didn't give me something, so I got angry. So now I'm, 25, and I don't get what I asked for, I'm angry. And then you have to go, okay, I got it, and accept it, and let it go, and let it go, and then reflect on it, and then it disappears.
Yeah.
And then the next one comes. It's horrible.
And then you start again.
And you start again. And there was, I had a friend, he's a coach that did that. And he was a rocket scientist, a real rocket scientist. He had 3 PhDs.
Wow.
Smart
man.
3
PhDs. Smart man.
And this guy did that, and then he really did the course I did, and he realized his father had said to him, because he did badly in maths, he said, you have to try harder. So he thought his father was disappointed, so he went and studied really hard. And then he goes, and now he's, what was he, about 35, he goes home and goes, Dad, you remember when you said that? Dad said, no, what are you talking about? Bang. And he stopped studying. That was it.
That's right.
It can be the person you meet, this particular partner that you keep meeting, that person, it's the same thing. Or being the angry one, the little one. But it could be you're not good enough. Always coming up. You've got to use that, track it back. I can't remember, whenever you were embarrassed when you were a little kid, and then you bring it with you into adulthood, you don't remember it, and you're just churning inside. Mm. And that's a really good step. As long as the awareness is understood, you've got to really think about it. So Recognize the circle, so it's happening again, you don't know why. Track it back to when it first started. Okay, you're kind of close. And then really, really picture it. Where were you? You're in your room. Who were you with? Was it the daytime? And then you can work into the next step, is the acceptance. You just, like, you're a kid and you got scared. And then let go, and then the next one will pop.
That's a very good one, yeah.
Yeah.
And a lot of things, actually, how we behave right now is rooted back when we are a child.
Yeah.
It's amazing how much childhood affects an adult. Yeah.
Bring it with you.
That's right.
I think to the Jesuit priest, say, give me the child, I'll give you the man. That was their old saying. You take a child and up to seven, and you can train them into your way of thinking. So a church or a religious organization or a government will want to educate you before you're seven, so they can influence the way that we think as adults.
Mm.
So going to, after you go to school, you need to unschool yourself.
I guess that's what we are doing right now. We're practicing to uncondition ourselves. Yeah.
Yeah, to become wise.
That's right.
Yeah.
And it takes time. It takes time to be able to see that clearly. And it takes with practice. And how we see it is not by force. Sometimes it happens in a blink of an eye. You just realize, oh, that what it was. You even didn't even ask for it. You just probably, when the mind is calm, the memory comes, and you realize that what it is. Because you feel there's a feeling tone to it, and there's association in the mind, and that's how you know that that's where the source is, and that's how you can work with it. Because a lot of times we can't work with what we've got because we don't see where the root comes from. So when you see the root, it's easier to uproot it. But essentially, when we practice even further, when we practice the Noble Eightfold Path, you actually can even see deeper. The whole notion of our suffering comes from the notion of self. If we can see the notion of non-self, literally you're liberated. But it takes time. It takes practice. But it's worth practicing.
Can you explain what you mean by the second arrow and making you think again?
Sure. So the first arrow is just the conditions of life. Like when you get sick, everybody, when they're born, they will die, they'll get sick, and there will be event where they're separated from their beloved. And those are part of life. And sometimes these are not something that you can even choose. For example, some people are born blind, for example. It's like a disadvantage, right? So they can't see clearly. They can't see even. They don't have the vision. So that is the first error. The second error is your reaction to the first error. So how you react to it. So if you have an accident, you lose a limb. How do you react to it, right? That's the second error. You can have second, third, fourth, and so forth. It depends on how you react to it.
Right. So when you did the arrow, like up to step one, and
is basically it's a loop process, meaning that it's an endless cycle. So we have to keep reflection. We have to keep doing the reflection part, and even after reflection, it's not yet finished.
Right.
Because you might not be aware that you will still do the same thing again. So that's why you need to be aware of your own mind and body so that you can be a better person as a result. Because eventually what we want is to be a better person, to be happier, to be more peaceful, and yeah, to be wiser.
To be free.
To be free, yeah, to be free from
when
something.
When you're a little kid, yeah?
That's
you're
right.
Free and poor, you are free.
Yeah.
You were just doing it, and then someone, you woke up, oh, you didn't wake up, you went, oh, my parents, not God, what happened? And bang, it's all downhill.
Yeah, yeah, when you feel free, like a burden is taken off.
Yeah.
So it's like liberating, it's very, very good feeling. But yeah, imagine that is a small liberation. Imagine the big liberation, as the Buddha mentioned, it's way more. You're like 24/7 happy. 24/7 peaceful. Yeah.
Pretty powerful.
Very.
Yes. I was thinking, when you, not only an internal awareness, so like when you get angry because a particular situation, and you always get angry over that particular situation, or you're angry at your mum or your dad, but also be aware of the people around you and how they're behaving, because they've actually, they could be behaving because of yourself. So you give out a certain energy, and then they may reflect that. So be aware of other people, because other people are your mirror as best you can.
Yeah, thanks for bringing it up. That's true. So it takes two to tango. So sometimes how people treat you is because how you treat them. So it's always good to reflect internally and externally how we behave towards others and how others people treat us at the same time. And in Buddhism, we also, if you want to understand yourself better, you also need to understand that our reaction is basically stems from our own liking and disliking. You can simply formalize it in a way that your reaction comes from your own feeling, whether you like it or you don't like it, or feeling neutral. When you feel neutral, you usually don't do anything. Sometimes you're not even aware of it. But then when you like, you want more. When you don't like, you want to push it away. That's a simple thing, that the reaction that we have, the second arrow that we have in our mind about things that happens to our life. When we like it, we just want it more. When we don't like it, we don't want it to be there. Yes, Alina?
So like, just to relate it back to like the topic, so would you say like the first arrow is like the challenges, and like the second arrow is like the feelings and emotions that come up with it?
Yes. Yeah. Yes. And we are not working on the challenges per se, but we are working with the second one. That's right. Because the first challenge, there will be a practical solution to it. For example, if you're stressed about work or assignment or exams, then plan your study. Plan, time it, manage your time, plan what you're going to study. There's a practical solution to it. But then sometimes it's harder to do it because of the second hero. And there's a story from a good monk called Ajahn Brahm. When he was a young monk, when he was back training in Thailand, so his teacher was asking the monks to move one pile of soil to one place to the other place. And he asked, and then the main teachers left, and then the more senior person or monk was in charge. And this senior monk was telling them, oh, move this soil to the other end. And they did. And then the next day, the main teacher came back and said, why on earth you put the soil there? I wanted me to bring it back there. So they had to redo the whole thing again and then bring the whole soil back. And then I have to give you the context. They were only eating one meal a day, and because he's a junior monk, so basically he doesn't get the privilege of the senior monk, so the food that they got probably quite minimal in amount. So he's tired, it's very physical, laborious work, and then it took them a whole day just to move that, and now another day to move it back. So he's upset, he's annoyed, and then he must have said, in his words, he said he was saying in English swearing words, which he wasn't supposed to do. And then the other monk, who is not speaking English, but of course understood his body language and the tone that he said, so told him, carrying the wheelbarrow is not hard. Thinking about it is hard. So with all these challenges, sometimes the solution can be very simple. Sometimes it can mean just doing it. But then we keep thinking about it, we keep complaining about it, we feel frustrated, we say this is not fair, blah blah blah, and those actually makes it harder to do the work. So just doing the work is actually probably much easier. So I take that story with me a lot of times, because sometimes I feel like that, you know, I feel like frustrated, why am I doing this? But if you think about it, doing it is actually not hard. It doesn't take you much time, it doesn't take you much brain power, and it's not even tiring, so why? So yeah, so that's what I meant. Yes.
Going off your story, which I found really interesting, I feel like a lot of people actually do say things like, I don't mind doing this, but it just makes me really annoyed. Like, for example, if a teacher makes you redo an assignment or something, a lot of the times they'll actually say, like, I actually don't mind redoing this, but it just upsets me so much. So why do you think that, even though there's sort of like an awareness there, so they know that doing the thing isn't hard, but they're still complaining about it nevertheless, like, why do you think we tend to do that? Like, why do we inflict ourselves with the second arrow?
Simple as, because we are not having a clarity of mind by doing that, actually is not helping. You don't have, you will lack of the wisdom to see that that behavior or that kind of reaction is actually not helping at all. And if you really, really be aware, it's actually rooted from ill will. It's the ill will that causes us to think and to feel annoyed. It's the not wanting. It's actually just a reaction to the feeling that you don't like it. And therefore you react it in a way thinking that I feel annoyed, blah, 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 it's not fair, wasting my time. But if you realize what you're doing to yourself, it's actually not a wise thing to do. Might as well do it. You have to do it anyway. You have to do it anyway, so why complain? Just do it. If you can, if something you can do can change the situation, yes, then it's okay. But if things that you're doing, you're reacting in a way that it won't change the situation anyway, you're just wasting your time and energy. Unless that will make an impact or a difference to the what's going to happen, do it. And when you do it, you don't do it with a lot of ill will as well. You do it because you understand that by doing that, things will change. And you're coming from a place where you want to improve things, not a place where you don't like things. So they're different attitude, different kind of thinking.
I feel like certain, like sometimes, like when you feel frustrated over like certain issues, is it more like because like you have like less self-centered, I mean like more self-centeredness towards yourself, means like you're magnifying like your own feelings instead of thinking about, oh, probably I do this, like thinking in a positive way. So is it like you're more self-centered in that
if sense? You're feeling frustrated?
Yeah, like feeling frustrated, let's say like when someone asks you to help out and do something, like adding to Katie's point, like you want to help, but then like at the same time, like, you feel like, oh, actually I don't feel like helping, but I just like feel that you need the help, but like actually I have something else to do, and then like you feel frustrated. Yeah, is that like magnifying like your self-centeredness and stuff like
that? I don't know whether I can say you're magnifying it, but it's a reflection that you have strong sense of self. I wouldn't say that you by doing that you're magnifying the sense of self, but it's a reflection that you do have a sense of self, because effectively the reaction comes from ill will, right? And that ill will itself, because of the notion that you have a sense of self, that's why you have the ill will. So people without sense of self, meaning that somebody who's let go of the greed, hatred and delusion, basically people who are liberated, they don't even have ill will at all. So how I see it is that ill will essentially is the self, if that makes sense, or sense of self, because self in itself is just not a reality. Yes. Yeah?
I guess in Victoria's example, she is kind of wanting to help. It's just that she is torn between like her wants to like help and also her responsibility on the other side.
No, how I see it is that you don't want to help, otherwise you're not feeling frustrated.
Oh, okay, the frustration.
Yes, you feel frustrated because you don't feel like doing the things. You don't want it. If you really be honest with yourself, you actually don't want to do it. But you feel like you have to do it. You understand? So this is how I judge the question. You feel like you have to do it, yet if you really be honest, you don't want to do it. So that's why you feel annoyed. The annoyance comes from, I don't want to do it. But sometimes you have to do it. It could be communication, and it's a simple...
disempowerment through not saying anything. Through feeling obligation to do things.
But it could be also our habitual way of doing things. Because sometimes we probably feel like we have to do it, where it, in actual fact, we don't have to.
So that's the circle again.
Yeah, you just need to be aware. Yeah, we can break it by being aware. And then if you want to be honest with yourself, if you don't feel like doing it, then you can tell the other person, look, sorry, I've got a lot of things to do. Do you mind if I don't help you this time? Next time probably I will, but just this time I probably have too much on. And probably the other person say, it's fine. Yeah. So a lot of times it's also our own preconception, our own expectation, thinking that we have to do it. But in reality, we might not.
We've been well trained to do that within the school. You're obliged to do things. And you're taught to do things that you don't want to do. So by the time you're an adult, you're well educated. So the power to say yes and the power to say no is important. And I'll give you a good story. I've lived in a home, Taiwan, right? Taiwanese people, and the lady's about 75, and she's very angry because she never said no to her husband's family. And they're from a traditional farming family. And she's angry at him all the time. She can blame him. But it's actually her fault because she never taught herself to say no. And her mother-in-law pushed her around a lot. And so she was very, very bitter. But I dragged her to yoga for a
while. That's a good thing for her.
Yeah, just to help her out. Mm. But yeah, so like, same, you can say no. You don't have to be angry. That's that letting go. And you can do it in a way that doesn't make them wrong, the other person. And it gives you the empowerment for yourself. And what can be funny is that you may say no, and then 10 seconds later you think, oh, I'll do it. It's fine. Because you've got power, internal power, mm-hmm. within yourself. And you might say, oh, I'll do it anyway. It's fine. Mm-hmm.
Mm. That's a good thing. It's a good point. And also I want to add on to that also. Quickly. I want to add on to that also. Yes, it's good to be aware that you don't want to do things, but also good to be aware also where it's coming from. It, like you say, is it selfishness? It could be. The selfishness could be that you feel more important, or you feel like, it's not my business or anything like that. That kind of thinking is not a skillful thinking. So being aware of that is also important, because we can slowly learn how to let go of them. It's not so much about whether to help or not to help, but rather also to reflect within ourselves. Do I have unwholesomeness in my mind? If I have that unwholesomeness, then let it go. Try to let it go. And then bring up the wholesomeness. And that's why sometimes, like... Sorry, what's your name?
Steve.
Steve, what's it? Steve has said, sometimes when people be honest saying no, and then suddenly they say, I feel like doing it, is the reason why is because in their mind, in their heart, they already let go of that ill will, and they become more free, and they feel inclined to help. Because people who, without the ill will or high sense of self, are genuinely willing to help anyway. So in that situation, a lot of times you will feel amazed that what's changed in the mind, and then how you behave accordingly, it can be quite interesting. Yeah. Sorry, what's your question?
It was originally a comment, but now it's turned into a question. So you know how in metta meditation you first send loving kindness to yourself, but if there is no self, like, why should we send it to ourselves first when, like, in Buddhism, we sort of say that there isn't a self?
Sure. The notion of self in Buddhism is about the permanent solid entity. So the body or the mind, it's a solid thing. But in reality, things are always in flux. Things are changing, things are impermanent. So it's really hard, even if the body with the body, it's really hard to pinpoint part of the body that is going to stay forever the same. Self-regenerate every few days, depending on which cells they are. But in microscopically, we can't even pick part of the body that stays forever. When you're young until now, your body has grown so much, right? Your look might be different. So things are changing. And that's why the Buddha said there is no permanent sense of self. There is no permanent entity, basically. Even the mind also changes. So that's what it is. Doesn't mean that this body doesn't exist. Doesn't mean that my consciousness doesn't exist. It's just the identity to it. It's just the identification that this is my body and this is my consciousness. The my, you know, the identification is the one that causes a lot of trouble. But you don't deny that this doesn't exist. It does. So when you practice metta, you practice for this body and mind. You still acknowledge that this exists. It's just that you try not to identify, to have a strong sense of self-identification.
Did anyone to Victoria's comment, I feel like if you have a responsibility that you want to attend to, but you feel like you want to, like, but someone asks you to help, then, like, maybe being aware that maybe not enough methods given to yourself first.
It can be. Yeah. Some people are yes person, right? Like what Steve has mentioned. Some people are yes person, and those people usually put others before themselves for whatever reason. It could be because they have a strong desire to satisfy and please others, so that, because without that, they don't feel like they are acknowledged, or there's a yearning for something. So there's a sense of lacking in there. That's why they feel like they need to keep saying yes. They need to keep pleasing others. But if you're not aware of that, then we're just not aware that we are actually harming ourselves, because we don't look after this. Because you have your own need, you have your own, basically need that you need to tend to. By just pleasing others, you're forgetting, you're neglecting your own need. So yeah, it needs a balance. In Buddhism, we practice middle way. We don't go to the extreme. You'll go to the extreme of one end. So we try to be balanced as much as we can. Helping others and helping ourselves. You know, just keep helping others, forgetting about yourself.
Just a point there, just be aware that you can be, as a female, pushed into being a yes person. If you talk to your grandmother, it's not that long ago that as a woman you'd have to be married at 18 or younger, and have kids by the time you're 20. And obviously the husband on his side, he has to say yes because he's been pushed to go to work. So these, we don't live in that, in this culture, but that's part of that yes system. You can be pushed into it.
Mm.
So be aware of it in your own families.
So talking about expectations, I guess just now when the conversation was going towards like expectation and everything, especially when you were still young and everything, I felt like it is needed because it kind of shapes how you behave as well, especially when you're very little. You don't know what is right and wrong, and by giving them rules, expectations, it sort of gives an environment, the right environment to grow up in. And yes, I'm just thinking that sometimes expectation can be good, but I think it does become a habit that you put expectation onto yourself, and maybe like very high expectation, and it does make you feel stressed. But I'm not too sure if it's that bad, because it sort of gives you a drive and motivation to push yourself further.
Yeah. I will use the word skillful or unskillful. So some expectations can be skillful. Yes, you're right. Like as a parent, you need to guide your children to behave in a way that will be acceptable to the society and also to behave morally. you don't want your child to tell a lie, you don't want your child to steal, you want to make sure they behave morally. That's actually a responsibility of as a parent. But the expectation that we're talking about is mainly about like a sense of controlling in a way, like you want things to be in a certain way. There's that level of expectations of wanting things to be in a certain way, and that is not healthy. Even as a parent who wish the best for their children, at times they need to let go of the expectations, because the expectations that the parents have might actually cause harm, even though they come from a good place. But because lack of wisdom, they can actually cause more harm than good. So there are sometimes, even though you think that the expectations are actually for their good, but if you don't have the wisdom to be able to see, you might not be aware that you're actually causing harm. I'll give you an example. If a parent expects their children to perform all the time, somehow subconsciously the child would feel that I need to perform all the time. And if, depending on the strength of the child, if they're not strong enough, what happens sometimes, it can be causing them anxiety. It can cause them anxiety that they can't perform, especially when they realize that they're actually having trouble with that, they're having panic attack. So those little expectations are the one that we need to watch. Expectations, it's called expectations because there's that level of controlling. But what you were talking about probably is a wish that your child to behave in a certain way, that your child will perform. Therefore, you support them as much as you can. But if they can't, then it's fine. You accept things when you accept the result, but along the process you support them, you guide them as much as you can, but eventually it's up to them how they're going to live their life. So yeah, expectations can be quite harmful if you not be careful, even on ourselves. Our own expectations is actually more harmful than our expectations towards others, because we cannot control what other people do. But certainly, what we think, what we say to ourselves, affects us the most, if that makes sense. Because we can blame ourselves for not having the result that we wanted, for example. If you have high expectations on yourself, then when you don't meet the expectation, then you tend to beat yourself over it. And people can fall into depression if they keep doing that again and again and again. It's not impossible to fall into depression because of that. So we just need to be aware what we say to ourselves, what we think. That's why it's important to practice kindness. And that's how you can overcome all these challenges. Be kind to yourself. And when you're kind to yourself, you tend to be kind to others as well. It's an interesting thing. How you relate to yourself, also that's how you relate to others.
Would you say that just what you're talking about now, with that tie in with like self-compassion and compassion towards others, how you can kind of really extend compassion to others, like once you have it for yourself?
Yes. Yes, when you have the self-compassion, your compassion to others is more in a pure form because you understand it. You can only give to others what you have. So if you have the kindness in the heart, you can give that kindness to others. If you have the self-compassion, then you know what compassion is from self-experience. And because of that, you can relate to others with compassion. Yeah. That's why it's important to have that towards ourselves first. And also with practicing of loving kindness, meditation or metta, we start with ourselves. The reason is we can only relate or give away what we have. If we don't have, we don't know what to give. If we don't have the kindness, we don't even know how it feels. How are we be able to give it to others? We can't. We simply can't. You can't give $5 if you don't have $5 in your pocket. It just doesn't make sense. So start with ourselves. Everything starts with ourselves. Even the practice of wisdom starts with ourselves. Because you understand how you tick, it's easier to understand how people tick. If you know how you react, it's easier to understand why people react the way they react.
I have a question about compassion. Sometimes it could be a very hard choice. For example, if you see a beggar with a baby, probably he used the baby as a tool to win compassion from others. You know, this is a crime. You will give her money, or you report her to the police, or what can you do?
I think it's a complex situation, especially in some areas where the situation is not as simple as you might see it is. But my rule of thumb is, if at that particular moment you feel compelled to help, just help.
If you help her because she knows if she put the baby into sleep, she will get more money, then she probably feed him with more sleeping pills and the baby will be sleeping all day and after him.
If you know for certain that's what she's doing, then probably you know the answer what to do in that instance, right? But what I'm trying to say is, sometimes we are not doing the kind act or the generous act because of our own thinking, our own doubt. That is a complex situation. Where, if I were in that situation, I probably wouldn't help, because I know the real help is actually to probably remove the child from the mother or the mother, quote unquote mother.
Yeah.
Or find a social system that can support these people, which is can be quite complex. That's why it's a personal choice. But if you feel compelled helping, there's no harm in doing that. That's my view anyway. Because when you do it genuinely, even though it might not be the most skillful thing to do, you benefit from it. You feel the joy, you feel the happiness from doing it genuinely, if you do it without expecting in return. But if you do it with expectation coming out of it, then probably you might not feel the same way. And that's a complex situation. And I agree with you, sometimes we need wisdom to be compassionate. So there's a good example by another teacher. His name is Rodney. Probably you heard of the story many times. So he called it idiotic compassion. So the scenario goes is, it happens to him, I think. So the story goes, there is this, if I'm not mistaken, she's a blind woman, right? And then, don't quote me on this, I probably misrecall it, but you will get the gist of it. But anyway, this blind woman had a lot of shopping bags, and somehow the shopping bags fell apart. Actually, no. I told a lie. Let me rephrase it. Maybe not from his story. I don't want to misquote it something. So anyway, the situation is, there's a blind woman standing at the traffic light. You happen to be there, assuming this woman want to cross the road. So you take her hand and cross the road with her, without knowing she actually wanted to cross the road. That is idiotic compassion, because you have a compassionate heart wanting to help her, thinking that she wanted to cross the road, but in reality she didn't want to. So that is an example of idiotic compassion. So you're helping, coming from a good place, yet lack of wisdom, right? So the situation might not need that help, if that makes sense. The woman doesn't need you to help her cross the road because she doesn't want to cross the road. Yet you come from a good place that you took her and cross the road with her. So that's idiotic compassion. So you're doing something out of a good place, yet without wisdom, not knowing that it's actually not needed. So in that situation example, I can't give you a definite answer, because it's up to individual how you want to respond to that. And it's a complex situation. A lot of countries or a lot of places have actually, like you said, it's a scheme. It's a scheme just to earn more money. And the way they're doing it is unethical. And whether you want to support that or not, it's up to you. And also what I'm trying to say,
I just think the best way probably the police. to crack down the crime.
That's right.
To stop it.
Yes, have the social solution to it. Because it's a social problem. It's not individual anymore. It's a social problem. It's a complex system. It's a system in itself. It's like a syndicate. So to uproot the syndicate, it needs a lot of work and effort. That's probably the best solution.
The best way to be activist.
I don't know. It's individual choice. It's individual choice. But what I'm trying to say also, maybe not necessarily the same situation, but in any other situation, when you're compelled to help, just help. Just do it.
You feel like you can help with that situation.
Yeah. Yeah. Just do it. Because there's no harm. You feel joy anyway after doing that. So.
Yeah. In the teachings, it's about letting go, and letting go is also letting go of opinions.
Yes.
Because people have their journeys and their experiences, doesn't mean that they're wrong. so not being, I believe, when you can acquire enough compassion and wisdom, you'll see them for who they are anyway, and you won't get drawn into their schemes, then you still be compassionate to them.
Yes.
Without being made a fool.
You see them as a human being.
Yeah. You just see them.
Yeah.
And that's fine. They can do their thing. Yeah. They're just like a monkey running around, throwing things around. It's fine.
Yeah.
And you're not getting drawn into their story.
That's right.
And still be compassionate to them.
Yes.
I think that's a better way.
Yes.
Because if I understand Buddha met many people like that, and would talk to them, but wouldn't be drawn into their world.
Yes, it's
same
possible.
I think Jesus was similar to that as well.
Yeah.
It gives you the ability to talk to anyone.
Yes.
Yeah.
To be non-judgmental.
Yeah.
To be open. To accept people as who they are.
Without being weak.
Yeah.
Something like that.
Compassion is not self-pity also. It's not about feeling sorry about oneself. Even though you feel the pain, but it's not about self-pity. Feeling sorry, why am I feeling this way? Why? It's so sad. Oh, it's so painful. Why? It's not like that. It's about, the simile that I can think of is about a mother caring for their sick child. Caring for, that's what compassion, quality of compassion is. It's a care. There's a care quality to it. And of course, there's also love. That's why before compassion, you have the kindness. There's a quality of kindness to it as well. Self-pity is just the opposite. It's not compassion. And true compassion actually heals. Where self-pity actually draws you down. But compassion actually heals you. Just like a mother looking after a sick child. The sick child gets better. So that's what compassion, the quality of compassion is like.
Does compassion equal to altruism?
Altruism? Yeah, it can be. Altruism is a manifestation of it. Because when you feel the pain of others, you want to help them. And basically altruism is about helping others. It's about wanting to make others feel better, wanting to help them overcome their challenges. Yeah, compassion is altruism is manifestation of compassion. Yeah.
Some people don't want to be helped.
Yeah, of course.
Be careful of that.
Yeah, of course, and that's when you also practice equanimity.
Awareness.
Yes, being able to let go. Yeah.
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 If you want to try so hard to help a handicapped person, and he or she may feel like humiliated, she thinks, oh, you're showing pity on me or something.
Then at that time, you just stop doing what you did, because you understand that they don't need that help. Therefore, there's nothing, you don't need to do it. Just like a blind person you think that the person wants to cross the road, you take her hand and cross the road with her, but that's not what she wanted or she needed. Similarly, if you feel like thinking that that handicapped person wanted you to help her, I don't know, carry her or whatever, but that's not what she wanted, then you let go. Yeah. And what you can do is simple. Ask. Do you need any help? Can I help you with anything? Ask. If you're not sure if that person needs that, ask. There's no harm asking. They will tell you.
So compassion should not be applied.
No, it should have with wisdom. Yes. Yes. Otherwise it will become idiotic compassion.
I've got a good one for you. This is December. You'll notice on the campus there's a fellow who's blind, seems happy around. And I saw him at a cafe called Coco, which is on the corner, the IGA. And I noticed he was having his beer, but he wasn't very happy. He kind of looked a little glum. And I was just observing him, and then I thought, I just asked him, I said, do you know there's a better place to have a beer? And he goes, oh, really? I said, yeah, it's called the White House. So I took him up there, left him there. And then when I went back late, he had three people around him. And he was having a good time. Mm. So just being aware of his body language that allowed me to ask him, there's a better place. Mm.
Yeah.
Mm. Yeah. Simple. Like sometimes you ask the person if they need help and they might say no. But if you think that they still need help, you can offer it in a different way. I think skillfulness is necessary in those kind of situations.
Sure. That's why you need the skillfulness comes from wisdom.
Yes.
If you have the wisdom, you know how to behave skillfully and to help them in the best way possible way.
One of my colleagues was asking the boss, do you need any help with getting the coffee out? But some of our other colleagues were thinking, you shouldn't ask that, you should just go down and help her get it out. So what do you think, like, in this situation?
about your colleague asking you help?
The colleague was asking my boss, do you need any help, or do you want me to come down to help you get the coffee out? But like in what was my opinion and some of my other colleagues' opinion was that because she's the boss, then we should go down and help her get the coffee out because it was quite a lot. So I mean, sometimes asking whether you need help is wise, but I'm not sure I was just challenged by what you said about asking.
That's why you need wisdom, because with wisdom that's when you know what's the skillful things to do at that particular situation. Asking help can be the good way, or right away doing it can be a good way.
Right.
Because if you know the person really well, you know what's the best action to do. Some people, the way they react, so it depends their tendency, their behavior, their habits. Because sometimes asking for help might not be helpful. Sometimes. That's why you need wisdom, yeah? And wisdom comes with experience, comes with understanding. And if you know.
In a different way.
Yeah.
So with that blind guy, I didn't ask him, do you want help? I said, there's a pub up the road. Would that be better for you? Because if you ask someone, do you want help, you may make them feel like they're
not helpless, capable.
And therefore they'll say no, when actually they do need or want help. Just rephrase it.
Or you can ask for help too.
Practice on this.
Yeah. Help me. It's good to ask for help if you need one. Yeah, you can build rapport by doing that. The good thing about asking for help from others, you build the rapport, you build the relationship. It's a very interesting psychology, human psychology. When you ask for help, the other person helps you, it's actually beneficial for the relationship.
Some people don't like to be asked.
Yeah, some people don't.
Men, older men, because it makes them feel like they're incompetent, like your fathers. So you have to do it in a different way.
Yeah.
yeah. So some blokes, you just tell them, or you just do it.
Yes, that's
right. You don't give them a choice.
That's right.
And they'll just accept it.
That's right.
Yeah.
And just take, if they're carrying heavy stuff, you just take just one box, grab it from them and just carry. And they wouldn't reject it because they know that they need help. But they are prideful. They're too prideful to ask for it. That's why I said you need wisdom to understand the other person, what needs to be done at the situation. Yeah. Like for my father, for example, I'll just probably just take the box instead of asking him, do you need help?
Yeah.
Because he would say no. But if I take it, he wouldn't say no. Right. So I just take it.
Yeah, that's it.
Yeah.
It's good for your relationships.
That's right.
Just do it.
That's right. Yeah. Very good.
And also you allow the other person to do good things.
Yeah.
They'll do it back for you. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. It's true. Like this is how I see it. Being generous, not necessarily giving away. Being generous also means to give another person a chance to do good deeds. Yeah? For example, if you're asking for help, you could come from a place that you want the other person to contribute. It's not because you really, really need help, but it can also be you want this person to feel they're included or to feel that they're part of the group, for example. It can be. So, yeah, don't see that asking for help or even accepting help necessarily a bad thing. If you use it skillfully, it actually can be a good thing. Another example also I like to raise is that in social context, usually, let's say you're hanging out with a friend and the friend says, oh, let me pay for your dinner. And sometimes it's a good thing to let them pay, not because you're greedy, but because you want to let them to have the chance to be generous, you know? Because otherwise, if you're the one keep paying, you don't give the chance to the other person to be generous. So maybe next time if somebody offers, just say, okay, I'll take it out to you. But not all the time, lah. Not all the time. If all the time becomes greedy, yeah? So, yeah.
The young ladies can offer as well. That's always good.
Not just the guys paying, huh?
Yeah. I had a good mate. She's from China. She paid for me all the time. She was called awesome.
You have a good friend.
Yeah. Well, I was always getting lost and I'd go find her and then get her back home. She was useless with directions, so she'd always pay for me. Yeah.
Good win-win.
Win-win.
Yeah. What time is it? Is there any more question?
I got a situation here. So there's one of my friends. I think she got a very complex and a hard, like young age life, and then she become very stressful in her studies and everything. And then I think this happens to a lot of uni students as well. They realize that there's a anger, there's pain and everything, but they are afraid that when let go of these feelings, they can't proceed anymore. Like proceed with the studies, and because they are afraid that they won't get the results anymore when they let go.
What do you mean?
So,
why?
Maybe anger and pain is what drives them to move further. I don't know. I find this very, very easy to understand.
No,
so
I.
So with negative feelings.
Yeah.
It actually. Like saying to myself that that's not enough or anything. I know that will drive me further.
But
I know that when I let go of this, I don't have direction and I don't I might not want to get that good results.
I see. Not necessarily the case. Not necessarily. In life, we always need direction. Otherwise, you'll get lost. You do need to be aware of what where you want to go. That's just a practical thing in life. You do need that. But you don't need to have that sort of level of direction or goal with a lot of greed or hatred, anger, whatever, to achieve that goal. Because you can achieve that anyway without all this sort of negativity, anger or greed. You can. It's possible. And it's more pleasant because what happens if when you're open, when you don't have that sort of preconception that I have to, that's where I want to go. But sometimes in life, you have to go this way. Like you have to do zigzag way to get to where you are. And then if you are so rigid in the way you think, this zigzag, it's going to be a lot of pain. You're going to feel a lot of pain because you have to do the zigzag. But eventually, if you realize, it's actually you're going to the same destination anyway. It's just a different path. You go through M5 or you go through, what is the other way? Parramatta Road, right? So, but eventually you go to the same destination. So it's important to know where you're going. Don't get me wrong. It's important. And you have to have that. Otherwise, you'll feel lost. And when you feel lost, you even first feel worse. But you don't need to carry your anger and your hatred or your greed with you to get to the destination. It's actually the journey itself becoming more pleasant without it. Because that way you can become more creative. You can be open to even possibilities that you didn't even think before. And maybe when you decide, originally you think that this is where I want to go, but with the course of life, you might think that, hang a second, this is, might not be what I want to do. Probably this, and that's fine. Yeah, that's fine. Problem is, if you're so rigid that you have to, no matter what, you have to be like this. That's why people cut corners, people do dodgy stuff, dodgy deal, just to get where they want it to be. And that's not healthy.
I think that comes back to the point that you made before. Like when you're being raised or you have children, you've got to strive for excellence. You've got to strive for excellence in things that you want to do, not in things you don't want to do. Like, But then if you don't know who you are, who you want to be, it's about your being, because you don't know who you are. No one does.
Yeah, no one does.
Yeah. Well, you wouldn't be here. If you knew who you were, you wouldn't be here.
No one really knows.
Somewhere. So do the thing that you want to do in your life and do it with excellence. But don't feel... And yeah, it's just, you'll just do it. And you won't be tired. You won't be stressed. It'll just be powerful. But if you're doing something that you're not quite sure about or you've been told to do, and you're working really hard, you're going to end your stress. Well, that's not healthy, because it's going to catch up. And when it catches up, your ambulance is coming, or your husband's dead, he's just stabbed you. You just lost it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Or you're miserable, your health is failing. Or you, yeah, so be really clear on that. If you don't know who you want to be, work that out. That's why you're here. And then if you're in the wrong place, like you're studying the wrong course, find the course that will allow you to be who you are. You may just want to be an electrician.
Which is fine.
So, you know, and obviously your parents want you to be a doctor.
Another example that I can think of is if you want to be a doctor, you need to study a degree, don't you? Yeah, that's what I mean. Like, you need to have a goal. Because otherwise you wouldn't even do the study. But to do the study, you don't need to feel, you do it with a lot of anger. I need to be a doctor, no matter what. You don't need to be like that. You just know what needs to be done to get to your goal. You just do it and plan accordingly. Yeah. It's important to know where you're going. Otherwise, you'll be sitting in limbo and not knowing what's happening.
That, like, sometimes not until like a week before that you start because you're not stressed enough before. And then, but I feel like, if you like set a goal for yourself, this like happened in the EXCO workshop, and like we set goals for ourselves. And if I like looked back on my goal and what I wanted to do, that kind of motivated me to like work on things earlier rather than be motivated by the stress and the like all that negative stuff.
Yeah. Agree. And that's habitual. And some people work well with stress, some people don't work really well under stress. And you can change that. If you don't like that, you can change that. It doesn't need to be like that. And yeah, it's habitual. If that's your habit, like you have to be doing things last minute, otherwise you wouldn't be productive, then up to you if you want to keep doing the same thing, because essentially it's your own decision, it's your own life. But there are many ways of doing things, you know, like not just like that. So you can manage your time, you can spread out the extent of things that you need to do bit by bit rather than one massive things at once, or whatever style that suits you the most. But that is stress, which probably not as bad as if it's out of anger, because anger itself wastes a lot of energy. Where stress can be quite motivating. Like there are some studies to say even some people need that stress to perform. Some people, not everybody, but some people perform better under stress. And if you know that yourself is like that, then yeah, you want to manage it to a point that it's not overwhelming. Yeah, you don't want to overwhelm yourself too much. But if you know that you're not performing well under stress, then don't give yourself in that situation that you have to do things at last minute. I'm a last minute person, I have to say. And I'm more productive when I know time is short. But doesn't mean I can't work when I'm not doing things last minute. I can. And I realize why I'm doing things last minute, why I procrastinate, is because I'm just lazy. Simple as that, I'm just lazy. And I'm making excuses in my head. In the end, I have to do it last minute. But if I just do it early on, I probably would have performed better. So, yeah. But it's habit. Coming from own experience, it's habit. I think most of us can relate. And it's not a good habit, by the way, please. Yeah. But you can plan. You can do some planning. You can manage your time. And that way it's actually better.
Oh, what's the information to like doing things in out of anger or negative things? Like, for example, I had a not very good science teacher in year 9. And a lot of like students weren't happy with him. And so I guess in a sense, like in order to combat that, we kind of were angry, but we were also like, and we would study like a lot by ourselves just to like because we wanted to do well. But I feel like rather than doing it, like it's more like resilience, calling it resilience, mm-hmm. rather than like doing things with anger.
I think when you do things in anger, you did things that you didn't want to do. But resilience, on the other hand, is a different thing. Resilience is the quality of endurance. So you be able to endure the challenges or the difficulties of the task or the things that you need to face. That's essentially what it is. But anger, on the other hand, for example, the activist can be acting it out of anger because they're angry at the situation. Yes, it can give you some level of energy. Some people are even having so much energy out of anger, but it's actually eating you up as well, because once that's gone, your energy just plummets. And with anger, if you react out of anger, you're not reacting out of clarity of mind. So meaning that a lot of times people, when they react out of anger, they do things they would regret. They say things they will regret. So you sometimes, if you can, don't develop the habit of doing things out of anger. Because if you keep doing that, it becomes a habit. When it becomes a habit, it's harder for our mindfulness, our mind to catch it up, because things happen really fast. So if you cannot, if you haven't developed it, don't develop it. But if you already have it, then work with it. Because it's not healthy. Yeah. No anger is healthy.
I think something I just add on to that is that I read a really good book recently, and one of the most powerful things that I found from that was, it was talking about like how all the time we just react, and we're so reactive towards situations, like we just have a default, when something happens, this is how we react, and often it's, yeah, something quite negative, whereas we don't realise that we actually get to choose our response to things. So it was saying that, kind of like in psychology, how they talk about there's like a stimulus and a response, but we actually, as humans, we actually have the power to choose what our response is most of the time. So I think a lot of people just have like a very sort of immediate reaction to things, and they don't even think they have a choice in how they react. So I think since I read that, like, it's been so helpful, because I think a lot of the time we just have these immediate reactions. For instance, my mom, she's like so reactive to things, she blows things out of proportion, just because, I don't know, she hasn't really realized that she doesn't have to react like that, and it's so automatic to her. Whereas like, actually, if you just take some time, and I think this comes in with like awareness and things, you realize there's a situation, and you're just like aware that you have the option to react in a number of different ways, and then you can choose which one's actually going to be better and slightly less harmful, probably.
That's right. Yeah, 100%. So that's the beauty of mindfulness. The more mindful you are, the more you're aware that you have a lot of options. Yeah.
Yeah, just based on that, just relating to myself. Yeah, there are times for me as well, like, even though I know those like steps, I'm like being aware and everything, but when things happen, I snap, my mind is really blank. And then, yeah, I'm a very reactive person, so just say it, say it. And then it's very hard at that single moment. But I think I'm improving, but then in that moment, yeah, you know, like, it just happens. And even though you know, like, you have to aware yourself and all these processes, only like 15 minutes later, or 20 minutes later, oh no, I should have done
that. Yes.
Like controlling the damage back.
Damage control all the time. Yes, because it's habitual. So when it becomes a habit, it happens really fast. And because it's so fast, you even need higher level of mindfulness to be able to catch it. So the reason why you keep repeating your own reaction, you keep reacting the same way, is because you lack of the mindfulness at that particular moment to stop. So that's why it's important to not just be aware of what happens between your ears, meaning that what you think or what you say to yourself, but also be aware of the body. Because, for example, I'll give you an example. When you're angry, before you started to feel anger, there are already changes in the body. If you can pick that up, it's actually quicker for you to stop the things that you don't want to have, you don't want to regret later on, if you know what I mean. Like, because sometimes you feel the heat in the chest area, or you feel like rush of blood going to your head area. There is some changes in the body. Just try to take note of that, because it's easier to pick the body, the sensation in the body, than to pick what's going on inside of our head. Because what's going on here happens really fast, but the body is more gross, and it never leaves the present moment. So whatever is happening in the body, it won't go away. Like, if you feel heat, you feel heat right now, you'll feel it at the time when you're aware of the body. So you'll never leave the present moment. So that's one way you can practice with, to notice the changes in the body. And it's interestingly, when you practice the body, you're too busy to be aware of the body that you don't even react sometimes.
Also, in the awareness process, is to trace it back to when it first started and think about that, and then accept it and let it go. Meditation's good as well. That gives you a space between
the mindfulness, yeah. One thing that I also want to think, say, is that it's also a good thing also to, let's say you're feeling anger started to arise. If you have the wisdom, you can pacify the anger. It's not just letting go, like some people say, let go, just be aware and let it be. Yeah, sometimes it works, but sometimes it's also wise to tell yourself to pacify the feeling. Say things that pacify the feeling. And if that anger comes from your own attachment to your own view, maybe you can tell yourself, maybe they're right. Maybe I'm not right after all. Try to balance the feeling. That's what I'm trying to say. Like, don't just simply watch. In the end, you can't even manage it. It becomes blowing out of proportion. But try a skillful means or skillful way to pacify.
Because mindfulness takes effort, and sometimes you're just so tired that you just don't want to put in that effort, then, like, yeah, I just wanted to make that comment. That, like for example, when you're really tired, at night and you want to go to bed, and sometimes I want to practice a bit of mindfulness before that, but sometimes I'm just so tired, I just can't be bothered and just let the thoughts run and then go to sleep. So
use your wisdom. If at that time you don't have the energy, it's time to sleep, then sleep. But if you feel like you are energized and you can do some meditation, then do meditation. So we don't have to be very rigid when it comes to practice. And practicing can also be daily life. You know what I mean? Like, not just sitting down and close your eyes. It's not the only practice. What you can do on daily basis is just to be aware of present moment as much as you can. Be aware of what you say to people. Be aware of what you say to yourself. Be aware of your own thoughts. Be aware of your reaction. Be aware of your body. That is what we can do on day-to-day basis, especially with what we say, because it can happen really fast. And be aware of your own intention as well. Watch that. Because we might think that we act on out of good place, but if you really watch closely, maybe not. Maybe you want the fame. You're doing it for the sake of fame. You're doing it for the sake of people liking you. Maybe not. So be aware of those. That's what the practice is all about. It's not just sitting down and close your eyes. Yes, it's necessary to do that, because otherwise you won't deepen your extent of mindfulness. But the day-to-day activity is also important. That's when you interact with people. That's when you do something. And that's when you create good or create bad stuff. So it's very important to also keep an eye on those.
What are we supposed to do during the meditation? Do we do the reflection process, or what I've done today, which is wrong, which is good, or you just empty your mind?
It's not emptying your mind. It's about, in simple term, it's about letting go. But what we letting go, and also just to practice to be in the present moment. How we do it, we use an anchor. So our mind is like a monkey. It keeps running, jumping, yeah, going there. It never really stands still. It would like to go around all the time. If you realize that, how long can you be quiet in the mind? It's hard, right? One moment you think about, oh, I feel hungry, I want to eat this. Oh, I have that cookie at home. Or when I get home, I'm going to open the cupboard and eat that cookie. And then it goes on and on and on without you even realizing it. So that's how the mind works. It's just like a monkey. So what meditation does is to calm the mind. So letting go is basically also about calming the mind. And we're doing that by having an anchor. We need an anchor. Just like, this is a good analogy from another teacher saying that, just like training a puppy, you tell the puppy, sit, and then the puppy doesn't want to sit, goes around. And you bring the puppy, say, sit, and then the puppy's still running around. And you keep bringing the puppy, sit, you keep telling the puppy, sit, sit. Eventually the puppy understand and sit. That's what we're doing with our breath. The breath is a good anchor because breath is neutral. We breathe all the time. It doesn't require a lot of effort. It doesn't require a lot of energy because we breathe anyway. If you stop breathing, you probably can die, right? So we breathe anyway. So there is there is no additional effort that you need. It's neutral in a way because you don't feel pleasant or unpleasant. You feel neutral about your breath. So breath is a good anchor. And that's why whenever you have distraction, you gently realize about the, you're aware of the distraction and bring it back. The awareness is like bringing, you see the puppy going out because you want the puppy to sit here and then the puppy just running around. That's the awareness. You see the puppy going around. What you do, take the puppy, put it back to where it should be.
So what you do is you only focus on your breathing.
As much as you can.
Your attention is only aware of your
breathing,
nothing else.
In simple way, you know when you're breathing in, you know when you're breathing out.
Okay, so you mentioned, you asked us to think about the happy things happen to us during the meditation.
That is to cultivate the kindness. What she mentioned about the metta, the loving kindness. One way is because we can't give what we don't have, but we need to know the quality of kindness first before we can even give it out to people. So my one of ways that I can think of is to think of the situations in your past that you feel the kindness inside. It could be when people help you, it could be when you do a good stuff, it could be when people shower you the love from that. There is a reaction in the heart when that things happen. And that's why the memory, bringing those experience into the memory, helps you to create the sensation in the body or the feeling of that quality. And when we keep doing that, it's easier for us to bring it up all the time. Because one of the factors of the Eightfold Path is actually called right effort. Right effort essentially means that it's an effort to not have unwholesomeness in the mind and to have wholesomeness in the mind. So one of the wholesomeness that you can have is the feeling of kindness. And the more you bring it up to your mind, naturally the better, because you feel happier, you feel light, you feel joyful. So that is actually one of the factors.
So we need to train our brain to think of the happy moment. Because when I hear you say, oh, think about the happy moment, as soon as I heard the happy moment, then all the sad moments come into my brain. So I give it the opposite way.
We can't control. Yeah. Basically, we have no control about this body and mind thing. You feel like you have control, but essentially you don't. But not necessarily you don't have control at all. That's not what I mean. What I'm saying is that you don't have full control of it. You can influence it. You can work with it, but you can't make it to happen the way you want it. Do I make sense? That's what I mean. Like, you don't have full control. Let's say you want to feel happy. You can't tell your mind, I want to be happy now. It doesn't work that way. Right? Similarly, when I say, try to bring up all the beautiful things that had happened in your life, yet you think of the opposite.
Opposite, yeah.
Then ask yourself why. Why?
Maybe the sad moments more than the happy moment.
I don't know. You should figure it out. Sometimes, subconsciously, we might feel that we are not worth the happiness. There are some people feeling that way, like they don't feel like they deserve to be happy. So you just, I'm not saying that you are like that. I'm just saying that some people feel that way. They just don't feel like they deserve to be happy. So there is a cause to why things happen the way they are. You just need to understand why. It's fine. You don't need to figure it out right now. It's like with time, you probably see more and more, and you understand yourself more and more, and then slowly you probably can change. Yeah. Sorry, somebody put up their hand.
I was just thinking it's part of step one. You're trying to create a sense of wellness and energy, and I don't say happiness, I say joy. Like when you're a little kid, it's joy, and it's internal, yeah? And it comes out. And happiness is external and comes in. So you want to recreate the joy. You can't do it if you're carrying large bags of unhappiness. And it's the baggage that's holding us back. But you don't even know you have it.
Mm.
And that's that number one.
Mm.
So if you're aware of that little circle occurring, that's a thing that keeps on happening, focus on that. Find out where is that coming from.
Mm.
I'm not good enough. I'm not smart enough. I'm not beautiful enough. Mm. My mother hates me, my dad hates me, whatever it is. Sort that out, use the steps. And then all that practice that you do will manifest because you've cleared your baggage. Yeah? Right.
I feel like sometimes with that, like Shifu, sometimes she starts her method meditation with something along the lines of, may I be free from greed, suffering. So like getting rid of those, not getting rid, but acknowledging maybe those negative emotions first and then developing the positive.
No, basically it's just a chant or mantra to help us, a well-wishing to oneself. So may I be well, may I be free from suffering, may I be peaceful. So basically it's just a well-wishing to oneself. You can also do that if it helps bring up the quality of kindness in the heart, then do that. But there are many ways. So this is just one way. Like I think it's also helpful by having incorporate the memories. So when you have the memories of the past, when you feel loved, because there's a joy and there's a beautiful softness in the heart because of that, or touched by somebody, or when you're feeling kind towards others, you feel the joy, you feel the kindness, the softness in the heart. And there are memory stays because of that. And we utilize the memory, and then the memory will create that sort of feeling in our heart. And the more we focus on that, it can grow. And the bigger the feeling is, the easier it is for us to share it out.
Just to add to that, there's actually a psychological study that, like, when you focus on more positive emotions, like positive memories, that can help you, like, be more happy. But at the same time, when we do mindfulness, don't we want to focus on the present moment? So if we, that's not really, like, focusing on the present, right? So I get, like, a bit conflicted as to that practice, I guess.
Well, you need mindfulness to be able to do that practice too. Because if your mind too scattered, you forget what you're supposed to do. So mindfulness is about remembering as well, remembering your task, what you need to do. So if the traditional is we're practicing on the breath, but also there are also many forms of meditation. There are also meditation which is more active, like loving-kindness meditation, where we incorporate a lot of we can incorporate memories, we can chant to ourselves, wishing oneself to be happy. But essentially, what you're doing is actually concentrating on one task. You understand? So when you practice with the breath, you're concentrating on the task of focusing on the breath. When you're doing the loving-kindness meditation, you're concentrating on the task of incorporating that to bring up the feeling of loving-kindness. So you're focusing on the feeling of loving-kindness rather than the breath. So they are essentially almost similar kind of practice, but in a different form. Yeah, you still need mindfulness when you do the metta meditation. Without it, you just think of cookies again or anything else. Yeah. Any last question? No?
I just have one last comment.
Okay.
You had joy in your lives when you were little kids. Try and remember that. Maybe that'll be a point that you can try and recreate in your current lives as adults.
Yeah.
Have that pure joy just coming out of you.
Yeah.
Yeah? So
yeah.
It's not something you're trying to experience anew. In that you've already done it.
Yeah.
So try and recreate it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Or alternatively, if you can't remember of those good stuff, then you can do it now and create more. But make a habit of collecting the good stuff of your life rather than collecting shit of your life. Yeah. It's a choice whether you wanna appreciate the good stuff or you keep focusing on the negative stuff that has happened. So I will encourage you to focus on the positive stuff because it's more helpful. And when you get to a stage where you can let go of both, then great. But when you haven't yet, just get the good stuff. Remember the good stuff. Remember not just the good stuff that happens to you, but also remember the good stuff that people done to you and what you've done to others. And then if you can also, pay attention to how you feel when you're doing good stuff. When people help you, when you help others. When people care for you, how you feel. Pay attention to it. The more you pay attention, the easier it is for you to practice it to make it grow bigger. So yeah. So I wish you all well. And I hope you can let go of as much suffering as you can. Thank you, everyone.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you, everyone, and thank you, Rosie, for talking about how to overcome challenges in life. And also, I hope everyone enjoy like the sharing session. Yeah?
So, before we end, I'll go through like the activities. So, English Dharma talk next week, next Friday, same time, same venue. So, the topic is Diagnosis of Human Suffering. So, it will be on the Four Noble Truths. And our speaker is Jin Teo. If you have any questions, you can contact me. And Chinese Dharma talk. And is.
Where?
Basically, where did Buddhism come from? I use old English, sorry.
Where did Buddhism come from?
Yeah.
Okay.
Whence came Buddhism?
Oh.
Okay, sorry. I can't really read. Okay, and our speaker is Venerable Nedrong. Venue is opposite. Time is 6:15 to 8. And if anything, can contact us there. And our weekly meditation on Tuesday and Thursday. The time is written here. And the venue is in Union Bus Library, level 3 upstairs, just beside the lift. And if anything, can contact Eva. And meditation workshop, I think I'll invite Eva up to kind of explain to you how is it like.
It's tomorrow, isn't it?
Yeah, it's tomorrow.
Yeah, it's Hi everyone, I'm Eva. So tomorrow we have a workshop. Called Mindfulness of Breathing, that's a topic. And it's basically when you focus on your breath to be aware of your body, your feelings, yourself, and just be more aware of your state, like whether it's emotional or physical. And when we come back to our body, we can also overcome challenges in our life. So I encourage you all to come. The speaker will be Venerable Sun Yung Byung Bong Hyun, and it's from 10 to 1. And any questions, contact me. So, any questions? Yeah.
Where is it?
Oh! Yeah, it's right, Square House 104, so just
next
that
door.
Room.
Next door.
Yeah, just next door. And yeah, it wouldn't, so there would be, it would start with an introduction to meditation, just what is it like, how it's about, and then we'll have some sessions with meditation with some breaks in between and Q&A. Mm. Any more questions?
The teacher is a nun, isn't she?
Yes, she's a nun, yeah.
Yeah. From a Korean tradition.
Yeah. Mm. No other questions? Yes?
What should we wear on the day?
Oh, so appropriate clothing. So, like, probably if girls and guys, like, anything below the knees. Also, like...
sleeves.
Yeah, sleeves. Sleeved shirts.
So
probably
pretty much what you would wear to a monastery, basically. So no skin tight clothing, no singlets or like short shorts or short skirts.
Yeah, and
so
make sure like and also like with your pants, like they don't have like massive tears or anything. Like that. Yeah. All good. Okay. Thank you. Come along, everyone.